welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 87, The Yoni, Sacred Symbol of Creative Energy. This is kind of a follow-up to the two-part show done a while ago on the phallus, sacred symbol of creative energy. Same publisher, Inner Traditions from Rochester, Vermont, different book, The Yoni, Sacred Symbol of Female Creative Power by Rufus C. Camphausen. The back cover states, fertility cults centered on phallic worship are well documented, but older and even more pervasive are the cults of the goddess and her vulva. From the naturally occurring yoni rock formations used as sacred places by indigenous Americans, to the Indian temple of the menstruating goddess, from the exhibitionist Shilanagig carvings of early Celtic churches to the ritual striptease found in Japan, the yoni reveals yoni imagery and veneration that spans many cultures and times. Similarly, with Native American cultures, the female has a lot of say and sway. They're often matrilineal cultures, and so we have a lot to learn from women and the feminine. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Wasn't planning to tie this show in with Mother Earth Day, but that is what's happening. Officially, 1970 is the official Earth Day, but if you ask the natives or the indigenous peoples, well, you know, Mother Earth Day goes back, way back, hasn't ever stopped. So here we are. The book, similarly to the book and the show on the phallus and sacred symbols and artwork. Again, there are ancient cultures where the depictions and rituals and holy texts and such like that, obviously a lot of this stuff gets suppressed. Otherwise, you know, we probably would have read it when we were in high school or when we got those elementary school sex lessons. But anyway, thanks to these kind of books and this kind of sort of esoteric knowledge, not really esoteric, but that's how it ends up kind of being, is out there more, and I find it fascinating. I've only really glanced at this book and read a few sections, but just I wanted to jump in and you know, get some of the message out there. The book covers, you know, some of the history, some of the original artwork, places where there are sculptures, There's an Australia picture. A rock painting from Arnhem Land. The Australian All-Mother is shown revealing herself to a circle of women, imparting her teachings concerning the female creative powers. And she's kind of sort of flying in the sky with her legs spread. So it's, you know, it's an obvious unabashed celebration of the female energy. And there are several examples of yoni symbology have been found in prehistoric caves of southern Europe. So once again, that aspect, it touches on some of the earliest goddesses. That's a whole study right there. Different cultures, the names, like even I think Easter goes back to Astarte, maybe from the Babylon or Samaria. So this book cites 40,000 to 30,000 BC. Artwork from this period has yet to be found. If we do not discover such items, it does not mean that no such art was ever produced. It may simply mean that less durable materials were used in their making. Anything made out of materials other than bone or stone, wood, fur, or leather, for example, will disintegrate over time and eventually perish. In 30,000 to 25,000 BC, the very oldest of all known depictions of the goddess, or the specifically female powers of women, are the rock-incised triangles and other depictions of the yoni found in many of the now French caves, such as La Pharasie, I won't try to pronounce them all, and the Dancing Priestess, 30,000 BC, discovered in 1988 at Galgenberg in present-day Austria, is unique among all other known figurines from this period in that she is dynamic rather than static in form. Although she is nude, with breasts that are carefully sculpted, her pose does not invite immediate associations with fertility. The figure most likely depicts an inspired shamaness going into trance before a gathering of her tribe. So, you know, various various rock formations and artwork done. This charts in 5,000 year periods, places from around the world. So again, as with the phallus sacred symbol, this, you know, it's fitting. This is the world we live in, as the natives say, as Mother Earth and Father Sky. You know, the rain comes from the Father Sky, impregnates the Mother Earth, and grows things. So this kind of imagery, it makes total sense. Truly ancient version, 15,000 to 10,000 BC, of the triple goddesses found in the much later religions of Europe and the Near East. By showing the yoni together with the moon's three phases, the Paleolithic artists demonstrate their awareness of the menstrual cycle. So again, these are things tied up with, you know, cycles and culture and such like. Here's an interesting a little bit here, because I don't know, that's another whole topic in itself, but pornography, no pun intended there. Pornography has, you know, gets a bad rap sometime. There's positives and negatives to it. But here's a little section called The Mythology of Striptease. And Shinto is the Japanese religion or spirituality. An old Shinto ritual celebrated annually in Japan includes the performance of a striptease in which the dancing priestess exposes her yoni in full view of the participants. The Kagura ritual, quote, that which pleases the gods, end quote, commemorates an ancient myth concerning the goddesses Amaterasu and Ama no Uzumi. In this story, public exhibition of the yoni is used to initiate a process of change, both on an individual level, freeing Amaterasu of her self-imposed prison, and on a planetary scale, inviting the return of light and warmth necessary to the survival of life. There are distinct parallels between this story and the Greek myth involving Baubo, B-A-U-B-O, the exhibitionist maid of the goddess Demeter. So, wow, yeah, I didn't know of the Demeter. The rebirth reminds me of, you know, this time of year with Easter. And then one of the names here is interesting. Amaterasu o Mikami, heaven radiant great divinity, is the translation. The Shinto goddess of the sun and as such of light and life had been sexually assaulted by her brother and was, quite naturally, deeply angered and depressed. Wounded, indignant, angry, and in pain, she left the world. Wanting no part of it any longer, she took to hiding in a cave, thus withholding light and warmth from the earth and all humanity. So that goes on and on. I think that's touching on the bit of the yin-yang there. And then it says, she positioned herself in front of all the assembled deities and began to dance the dance of life. Enticed by her charms, everyone except Amaterasu watched Ama no Uzumi's performance. Once Ama no Uzumi knew that she had everyone's undivided attention, she lifted her skirt and exposed her yoni for all to see. The people in the assemblage roared with laughter and clapped their hands, and the noise carried far, all the way to the cave of the sun goddess. Curious about the ruckus, curious at how anyone could be joyful while darkness had fallen, Amaterasu left her hiding place, coming out of her cave to be once more among the living. Once again, there was light. It is this beautiful myth of a divine striptease that has given rise to the Japanese Kagura ritual, a ritual that has been enacted every year since the dawn of memory in a celebration during which a human priestess plays the part of Ama no Uzumi, and in which the audience consists not of deities, but of an assembly of faithful temple visitors. Exhibition of the yoni has become so deeply embedded in Japanese culture that its basic content is still operative even in a non-mythical, non-religious, and more or less pornographic context. The sacred Kagura ritual laid the groundwork for the profane tokudashi, another kind of ritual that is regularly staged in some of the more luxurious erotic shows and striptease parlors in Kyoto, Tokyo, and elsewhere in Japan. So again, there's a lot of history behind this. It blends the history, mythology, the culture, and, you know, astrology, science, different information, cycles. A few things I wanted to add from my learnings over the years. One from the Latin American countries, the phrase Pachacuti. Well, first of all, Pachamama, the earth mother, Mother Earth, the Latin American word, and Pachacuti is a phrase that the way I heard it is that the earth needs rest. Sort of like along the yin-yang principle, or just look at every day, you know, every day we have day and night, we have time to rest, and the earth, particularly now, in a cycle of needing rest to heal. And when you consider all the beatings, the rapings, the mining, the destruction, the mountaintops being blown up, and all kinds of shit like that, that, you know, luckily there's more awareness now, and it seems like things are changing for the positive. But, you know, I think it's important to keep that in the heart mind, the Pachacuti, that there are times when, you know, sometimes it's just better to do nothing and let the earth or let some area be. And, you know, I don't know how that, maybe that applies personally in your yard or wherever, but certainly on a wide scale level, this kind of consciousness is helpful. It's part of what the native peoples, the Lakota, the Tipi spiritual camps are doing. They're, you know, they're saying no to the tar sands KXL pipeline. It's like saying, you know, they're saying no, the earth needs to rest, not just rest, but it's also protecting the sacred water. So in all these areas, it's an important facet to help the cause. There's also a time, as I quoted Evo Morales in 2012, December solstice speech he gave on the new era, the end of the matcha and the beginning of the pacha. This, as I've heard it in other circles and consciousness awareness of, this is a new era that is sort of highlighting or accentuating the sacred feminine energy. You know, the male dominated business world, educational system, religion, all that has been dominant for 500 or 5,000 years, I don't know. But you know, at some level we see a lot more women in government now, a lot more maybe sports athletes, we notice women more. But in any case, it's, you know, it's this tide shifting, not just culturally. Like, sure, it's great if there's some women in politics, but I think it runs deeper than that. I mean, that can have a long-term positive effect, but I think also it's even deeper, that there's this honoring of the, you know, the sacredness of the feminine, not just the feminine as a woman, but the feminine energy, and that the men need to maybe, to coin a new phrase, step away from the plate and get with the program. But that this sacred feminine energy is that, you know, the way they say women's intuition, and because of a woman's menstrual cycle, she has a built-in connection to the cycle of the moon and the tides. And then just that feminine connection of birthing that there is that innate sense of connection with the Mother Earth. And so maybe it takes, I think it does take a little extra time for the males to kind of connect with that. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. And then from the Kabbalistic, Kabbalah perspective of the Tree of Life, which has a central pillar and a left and right pillar, and there's a mix of male and female, and on the left pillar, the feminine pillar, there are, there's different archetypes of the feminine. I think we see this with the, the virgin and the whore and the crone, and in the Kabbalah, there's like an earth mother, and there's also a mother of justice and severity. She's going to kick ass when necessary. And then there's the mother, the great mother, who just knows everything, understands everything in that deep perspective. So again, a reminder that there is a male-female balance thing going on, and there is a sense, and the way I hear it from Native peoples that remind me that there is the Mother Earth, not only alive, of course, but there is a consciousness, to try to cultivate that connection with the actual consciousness that is talking to us, and be guided by that and nurtured by that, and learn maybe what she wants from you. I know one thing that's helped me over the past few years is just when I stand out in the yard is standing with my feet with the earth, and taking it as a kind of communicative prayer time to connect with the earth and feel that connection. And it takes consciousness to carry that with me. Get in the car and drive somewhere, walk on the concrete. It's easy to forget, but I think part of this era we're in is that we need to make it easy to remember. Another scientific thing, I forgot to look it up, but I'm just going to say what I remember, is that there's some study, biology has shown that even that part of the female anatomy, part of the clitoris, is akin to the male phallus, whether it's the sensitivity or the physical makeup of it, I don't know exactly, but it was another example of showing, again, how the male and female are there's overlap, and that we each reflect both. So it's a very interesting, again, this book talks about, rituals and different cultures, Buddhist visualizations, tantric practices. There's a human yogini of the 8th century, Mahasukha Dasidi, adept of great bliss, was once one of those Tibetan women who initiated male practitioners into the tantric arts. So, there's a very graphic, again, spread-legged picture of this Buddhist-looking figure in the drawing. And again, I think we tend to think that some of these, quote, religions, we don't hear about it. It gets squelched a lot of time. So this is a way. There is the information is out there. Again, this book touches a lot on India and Japan, and then surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, there's a section on Islam and some of the most sort of backward countries, cultures today. No offense, but in the religious repression sense, it is offensive, the disrespect for the female, Islamic and Arabic, maybe not the true practices, but probably the extremists or the super religiots tend to squelch that stuff. So again, another angle that this book is quite fascinating. And of course, the artwork of Georgia O'Keeffe is always compared, flowers are flowers, but it's always compared with the female anatomy. Now, here's an interesting one, being a devotee of Lao Tzu. I just saw this one. Here's just jump in on the paragraph here. A similar case of such dispute over translation has lately befallen the famous Tao Te Ching, the most basic text of Taoism by the legendary Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, 6th century BCE. This dispute concerns the meaning of a particular Chinese ideogram that is part of the quote reprinted at the beginning of chapter 5. According to the native Chinese author Chao Tzu Chi, the newly discovered silken manuscript of this ancient document having been found among the Ma Wang Tuai text. There's a footnote there, but we'll skip that. Does not use the ideogram valley, but the ideogram desire aroused by looking at the female genitals. Western sinologists, however, do not like to attribute such lustful words in a sacred text to the semi-divine Lao Tzu, and remain adamant that the ideogram in question can hardly mean anything other than valley or valley stream. However, in consideration of the context in which the ideogram appears, the age of the text in question, and the pervasiveness of yoni worship around the world at that time, the new insight makes sense. If the alternative ideogram is substituted, the quote in question reads as follows. Desire aroused by seeing the yoni never dies. It, the yoni, is named the mysterious female, and the doorway of the mysterious female is the base from which heaven and earth sprang. It is there with us all the while. Draw upon it as you will. It never runs dry. Well, there again is a remembering that from the phallus book, and it talking about the phallus as this, you know, not only the physical sexual aspect, but the sacred divine symbol that, you know, in a way of paraphrasing, that the divine spirit God is in some manifestation a phallus that is ever aroused, ever resting, ever ejaculating and creating new life. So again, here we have this in the spiritual sense of the yoni, you know, ever, you can read it however way you want to read it, but I think that's, you know, it deserves pondering. And it goes on to quote the Upanishads and various sort of scientific, mostly wind up with this show with a reading of the Arabic phrases for the yoni. But this section talks about Japan, the elemental yonis, the five elemental yonis, the dark earth yoni, one that envelops and holds the lingam being the male phallic symbol, Mizu Tembo. I won't read all the Japanese here. The most water yoni with a small opening and a wide interior, the hairy fire yoni, ever sweet tasting and insatiable. The soft wind yoni, also called the flying dragon, because those who enter this silken tunnel feel as if they are flying in heaven. And the celestial yoni, most beautiful and fragrant, also known as dragon's pearl, because the tight opening and narrow passage lead to a pearl-like womb, and anyone fortunate enough to enter such a yoni is said to cry out in ecstasy. Then we go to China, the eight valleys and the three-story tower. This has other various phrases. Do my Johnny Carson imitation here. I have the phrase, North Pole gives new meaning to North Pole. Then we go to India. 36 combinations of types and temperaments. The three temperaments, the woman of Kapha, lymphatic temperament, has a yoni that is described as cool and hard, fleshy yet delicate. The woman of Pitta, bilious temperament, has a yoni that is soft, hot, and relaxed. The woman of Vata, windy temperament, has a yoni that is not smooth, but rough as the tongue of a cow. Now, if you study any of the kind of Chinese and Asian system of elements and types, again, it at first seems like, oh my God, we're describing these things, and how can we be so graphic? But it fits like any part of the physical body that is going to connect with the elements. And then another, besides the three temperaments, the three kinds. The female gazelle is the woman with a deep-set yoni, six fingers deep, that is cool as the moon and has the pleasant scent of a lotus flower. And then the mare, M-A-R-E, is the woman with a yoni nine fingers deep with freely flowing yellow juices and the scent of sesame. The karini, she-elephant, is the woman with a yoni 12 fingers deep with abundant juices that smell like elephant's musk. And there it goes on for other phrases, the lotus woman, the fancy woman, fairy or conch woman, elephant woman. So again, just as, you know, no two fingerprints are alike, I guess that applies to both phallus and yoni. And before getting to the Arabic bit, the terms based on the Greek konos, K-O-N-N-O-S, and subsequent Latin, C-U-N-N-U-S, derived from the names of goddesses known as Kunthus, K-U-N-T-H-U-S, a Greek goddess of fertility, and K-U-N-T-I, an Indian goddess of nature and earth. Think of the conch shell. Again, dictionaries and terms of words, whether poetic or, you know, just shapes, fruits, and alleyways and such like. Poets could have a sort of field day with these. And on, gets into modern artists, ancient myths. And quite a fascinating book. There's some indexing in the back, some explanations, some actual typography, almost like a elementary or high school sex book. So really, kudos to the people who published this for taking it on. There's a lot that could be done on this topic, and perhaps when I look at the book a little more deeply, perhaps we'll do another show. But I wanted to kind of segue from last show with the amount of season words for cherry blossom with Japanese, and riffing off the amount of Eskimo words for snow. And then there's a quite fascinating section in this book called Arabia, Acceptance of Endless Variety. And we've heard of the Kama Sutra from India, but this is an erotic manual called The Perfumed Garden. And what interests me particularly is that sometimes in these books that show the ancient artwork and ancient culture and the respect and the way the eroticism, call it what you will, is part of the spirituality, part of the culture, is that there are often many references to modern-day cultures that we think of as, and that may actually be, extremely backward and prudish. I don't know much, but as far as, you know, Islam, Arabia, some of the women, you know, barely go outside without having everything covered but their face. So there's a lot of backwardness, in my opinion, and these books kind of highlight that the backwardness comes from this kind of squelching of originally wide-open material. So that's another angle on it. The Perfume Garden, it says in the back, was written by Tunisian Sheikh al-Nefzaoui, 16th century, and translated into English by Sir Richard Burton in 1866. The text begins by praising God as well as the human genitals. It could be different things or the same things there, but anyway, the quote, "Praise be given to Allah, who has placed man's greatest pleasure in the natural parts of woman and has destined the natural parts of man to afford the greatest enjoyment to woman." Well, I would respond to that by saying, you know, there may be the women with women, but, you know, that's a whole other topic there. Apart from telling a number of erotic fairy tales, the book goes on to name, explain, and describe 25 coital positions and techniques. At the end of this section, the author adds, "If there be anyone who thinks that those which I have described are not exhaustive, he has only to look for new ones." And interestingly, the Perfume Garden also contains a large collection of yoni and lingam. That's the Hindu word for the masculine symbol, the phallus term. Terminology, yoni and lingam terminology. Besides the Arabic names and their translations, it describes 35 types of lingams and 38 types of yonis in terms that often afford insights into the psyches and behaviors of males and females of that culture and era. So looking at these, they are the descriptions. I basically just want to read them. I found them fascinating in the amount of description, and also the it's kind of poetic, and I guess you learn from it what you will. I won't say all the Arabic words because I don't have much of a clue, but they're all with El Arid, El Shuk, El Dukak, I don't know how to pronounce them, so we'll skip that. But and then there's a few with a different Arabic, but anyway, here we go. Starts off with the large one, the thick and fleshy yoni of a large and heavy woman. The primordial, a general term applied to any kind of yoni. The chink, the hard yoni of a very lean or bony woman with not a vestige of flesh. The crusher, a yoni that makes crushing and clinging movements upon the lingam once he has entered, takes him into her grip with the pelvic muscles and would, if possible, even absorb a man's testicles. This type of yoni is also known as the unionist, the sucker, or the biter. passage opening slit, the most general Arabic term for the yoni without any typological specifics. The same word is also applied to a passage between two mountains. Interesting is the fact that with only a slight punctuation mark added, the term means deliverance from misfortunes. The hedgehog, name for a yoni dried up with age and with bristly hair. The beautiful, a yoni that is white, firm, and plump without any deformity and vaulted like a dome. A mere look at her makes a feeble erection into a strong one and is almost impossible to take one's eyes off her again. The hot one, the highly esteemed yoni that is both tight and warm or even hot, possessing an intrinsic heat that equals the fire of love. The fugitive, a small and tight yoni that is also short. With penetration often being painful, she is a fugitive trying to evade many types of men. The restless, eagerly moving yoni of a woman starved for sexual play and enjoyment, very similar to the descriptions of the accommodating and the assistant. The vulva, the name usually used for the soft, seductive, perfect, and pleasantly smelling yoni of a young woman, plump and round in every direction with long lips, a grand slit, dry yet warm. In the text, the prayer, "May God grant us the possession of such a vulva," follows this description. I guess possession, you know, if you're a woman, possession, if that's from the man's perspective, that is a problematic, in my humble opinion. The delicious, a yoni with the reputation of affording unprecedented pleasure. The long one, a name for several types of yoni with an outer appearance that is long and reaches from the pubis to the anus, seems to lengthen when the woman is standing or lying down, yet contracts when she is sitting, differing in this respect from the vulva of a round shape. The bottomless, a deep yoni with a vagina that is longer than usual. Such a woman will require a certain type of partner or activity to truly arouse and satisfy her fully, the deep one, which, quote, always has the mouth open. The swelling one, a strange name or perhaps a bad translation, since the text makes it clear that swelling refers not to the yoni but to the male approaching her. The yoni herself is only described as opening and shutting convulsively like the vulva of a mare at the moment of climax. Now, one thing realizing while reading these is that, you know, perhaps this sort of science is relevant to how couples get along or don't get along. You know, it's I don't know how this information was or is fully used, but that's something to consider. The vast one, a yoni who opens herself wildly when excited. The voluptuous, a name for the yoni of a young girl or woman before her first coitus. The resigned, a yoni that suffers resignedly any number of penetrations and even violent and prolonged coition. Even after 100 times and with several partners, she would not be annoyed, but would rather give thanks to God. The yoni who makes no noise, even if she is entered 100 times, that one's the silent one. It's about 8 more here. The yearning one, a name for the yoni of a woman who has been abstinent for too long or who is naturally more sexually demanding than her partner. The importunate, the tireless yoni of a free and passionate woman with strong sexual demands who would still want more even after 100 times. Typically fearful of such women who are the pursuer instead of the pursued, the author writes, "Luckily it is a rarity and only found in a small number of women who are wild with passion, all on fire aglow." Little did he know. And the starling, the yoni of a very young girl. The wasp, a yoni receiving her name by the nature of the pubic hair surrounding it, or as the text describes it, by the strength and roughness of its fur. To the entering lingam, the hair feels like stings from a wasp. And a little bit extra section here. The perfume garden provides with a number of names that seem to concentrate not so much on the yoni as a whole as on the specific appearance of the clitoris or the labia. The double-lipped, the yoni with lips that are either long and hanging or that are exceptionally thick and large, as in the case of some very full women. One with a projection, a name for a large yoni with a projecting fleshy forehead. The snub nose, named for a yoni with thin lips and a small tongue, small clitoris. And the crested one, a yoni with a red comb like that of a cock, which rises at the moment of enjoyment. And in the book he adds, "Medical science, biology, and psychology attempt to know every minute variety of human nature and the mind, but these disciplines fail completely when it comes to human sexuality. Already stated, within the realm of biology and medicine, one studies the yoni and the womb in terms of fertility and diseases only. Within sexology, one studies measurements, contractions, dilations, and orgasms. If we as a culture allow ourselves to put aside the Judeo-Christian shame connected to the sexual aspects of the body and embrace the Eastern acceptance of yoni variety, we can develop a comparative aesthetics that would make every woman appreciate her uniqueness. Now that is well said. All right, we're going to go out with a song. You'll have to forgive my little bit of sense of humor, but it's meant with respect. Back in the 70s, a song by Helen Reddy, I Am Woman. So happy Mother Earth Day, and with a bow to the feminine, the females, and the feminine in the man, and the Mother Earth. And actually, ancient Egypt has Nut, the female of the sky. So again, Mother Earth is a fitting way to connect and with all the gifts and fruits that she bears, but as well, we extend this metaphor wherever. So here's the song.
It's just been released in Britain, and it's a song I'm very proud of because it was the first song I ever wrote that became a hit. It was my first number one, and the United Nations has declared 1975 to be International Women's Year, and they have chosen this song is their theme.